Welcome to the Empathy to Impact podcast brought to you by Inspire Citizens. I'm your host, Scott Jameson. On this podcast, we are going to be diving into the voices and stories of students who own their learning and impact their communities. Thanks for checking out the Empathy to Impact podcast. Today, we are making a bit of an exception to our usual format and not having students on the podcast for this episode. Instead, I am very excited to have author Nolan Higdon, who is an author and university lecturer at Merrill College and the Education Department at University of California, Santa Cruz. Higdon's areas of concentration include podcasting, digital culture, news media history, and critical media literacy, which all resonate so much with our work at Inspire Citizens. And I am really excited to chat with him about a new book that he has out. It's called Let's Agree to Disagree, A Critical Thinking Guide to Communication, Conflict Management, and Critical Media Literacy. So Nolan, welcome to the Empathy to Impact podcast.
Hey, thank you so much for having me, Scott. This is really cool.
I just want to start by asking, what inspired the book? What led you to see a need for a book like this and led to its creation with you and co-author Mickey Huff?
Yeah, it's a really great question. There were sort of multiple factors that inspired this text. One of them was, if you just sort of look around at the culture in the United States, you could see that we are increasingly becoming more and more divided. You know, you'd hear these stories of family members who no longer talk or friends who are not friends anymore because of politics. And it was no longer, you know, we disagree with this side or that side. It's that this side wants to destroy my way of life. And being researchers of democracy, we knew you can't have a democracy when you look at your fellow citizen, not as someone you disagree with, but an actual enemy. So that was one major factor. We knew from being news media scholars that news media stoked this. Their business model is such that division, making caricatures of the other side as a bad guy, increases ratings and subscribers. And then I think more importantly, and really this gets into your field of work, Scott, we started to notice this bleed into the classroom. Students and sometimes some teachers we would come across felt very comfortable kind of villainizing ideological enemies versus trying to interrogate and understand them or even reach out to them. And this was a great concern for us. You know, we're very passionate about education. We think, you know, education is a space where we can disagree, but we can at least come to understand one another. And we kind of rise above the vapid talking points and insults. And we come to some factual understanding of the quote unquote other side. And we just saw that was all lost. And so we thought, you know, what would it look like if we had a book that made the classroom into a space where people learned and used critical thinking skills, critical media literacy skills, and constructive dialogue. And so this was kind of the text where we teach the skills, we show people applying them, and then we bring up contemporary contentious issues, right? Like cancel culture, the debates over critical race theory, and we encourage students to engage in those debates in a constructive way. So that way it's very relevant to them, yet also digestible.
I love that. And I love how you've brought in a lot of these big divisive issues that we're seeing in the media that students are talking about and not really shying away from those, but really encouraging in a way through the text for students to get involved in these conversations in a nonviolent, productive way. Why is it important to have conversations with people who don't share our opinions and beliefs?
It's a great question, and it's a question we've sort of haven't really thought about, at least in my estimation, a lot in recent history here in the United States. A democracy necessitates that we communicate with one another, we debate constructively with one another, so we can come to understand one another. Also, we can't really identify problems in our own thinking unless we're challenged. You know, we need to be able to defend our position, one, so we can make sure we've sort of, you know, got everything correct, but also so we can convince others. This is what democracy is predicated on. And in an age when digital tools allow us to block and customize our communications to only reinforce our views, we have less and less of those opportunities. Public spaces are fewer and fewer. Classroom is one of the few places where you can meet people you disagree with. And so we challenge students and educators in the book to serve democracy in the sense that force these debates. If you really think that your position is the correct one, you should be able to defend it. You shouldn't be scared of that. But if you're afraid of engaging with people who you disagree with, then it shows you probably have a lack of confidence. And we want to give students that confidence. You know, I can't tell you how many times we've been out with this book and people have said, well, it's not my job to teach other folks. And I disagree. I think it's all of our jobs. This is a democracy. We need to persuade people. We need to create coalitions to get behind policies and positions that we want to see come to fruition. And a democracy is a 24-hour-a-day job. If you don't want to work 24 hours a day on your system of government, you're in luck. There's a lot of authoritarian regimes who are looking for people they can exploit, some docile bodies. But in a democracy, we have to reach out. We have to convince that other side. We have to also learn from that other side. And so that's what this book is trying to do.
I think it does a really good job of that. And I really see a strong connection to democracy. And you've talked about already how we're sort of seeing that erode from people ending up in silos or these echo chambers where they're only hearing things that support their own beliefs. How much is that attributed to today's media landscape and social media? And how do we help students navigate this complicated digital space that they find themselves in?
I think one of the ways we don't do it is tell them just simply to turn it off, right? I think, you know, any of us who've been in the classroom know that students can smell through that solution, that it doesn't pass the test. Being sort of honest with them, like, look, these are, whether it be a social media platform, a Google search, or news media, they have a business model and their goal is to make money. And the business model they found that works is to make you feel like you're quote unquote the good guy with the right position and that the other side is the quote unquote bad guy with the bad position. And so they create this caricature of your enemy. You're reinforced through your feed and through news media to hate that enemy and feel good about yourself. So you don't interrogate your side, but you have only bad things to say about the other side. And time and time again, the business model works. People go back to get confirmed in their views. They like it. And if you stick to a homogenous media diet, that's what's going to happen to you. You're going to feel more and more confident about a view you have that really goes unchallenged and maybe baseless. And you're going to have more and more of kind of a surface level understanding of the other side, almost like a caricature. And the reason why that's problematic is a caricature isn't human, right? So you don't have to recognize the humanity in this person. You don't have to work with this person. And that becomes really dangerous, right? We have to understand the humanity. We have to have empathy for people. Since I wrote my book, The Anatomy of Fake News, I constantly get emails from people who say, you know, your book was really important to me. I wish we had it a year ago or 2 years ago because my so-and-so, my aunts, my uncle, my friend, I've lost them to fake news. You know, they didn't want a ventilator because they didn't believe in COVID and they passed away. It was an email I read recently. And I try and remind people that false information can make otherwise good people do bad things. So we have to, you know, separate recognizing the humanity of this person from the acts that they may have done and really try and be a positive force in reducing the negative effects of that information. And that necessitates recognizing the humanity, which we talk about a lot in Let's Agree to Disagree.
I think that empathy piece is so important. And you do bring that up in the book. When we do vilify the other side, we lose that empathy. And in order to move forward as a society, I think we really have to find ways to help students and help everybody really to sort of build that back up again. And if we don't have empathy, it's really hard to really connect with the other side, I think.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I don't think you can have respect or decency or civility until you have that sort of empathy and respect for the humanity of the other person and some humility in yourself too, right? So this book isn't just about read this book and go out and wag your finger at other people. It's also a lot about self-reflection. You know, what can you do on a personal level to change? Personally, one of the things I'm sarcastic a lot in the way I communicate, and I know that's led to problems. So like reading this book, I had to kind of reflect like, do you always use sarcasm at the right time, or are you making the situation worse? So I think there's something in here for everybody to kind of reflect upon.
You talk about how when you're putting this book together, the importance of diversity and having a variety of different perspectives. Why is that so important when we're thinking about topics like this?
Diversity is, you know, it's a source of strength. It can be eye-opening. Just because you listen to a diversity of views doesn't necessarily mean you need to accept them. But it's good to kind of know where you sit and see things through a different lens. So you being Scott, but you being the audience, and you being me, Nolan, we've all been raised in a certain environment. We've seen the world in a certain way. There are other people who see it in a different way. And understanding those perspectives can help us understand where they come from. What do they see that sometimes we don't see? Your identity sometimes blinds you to the way that others see the world. And so thinking about looking at the world through other views can take off some of those blinders. And again, get back to that empathy piece where it's, you know, I don't know what it's like to go through that, but I see that that, you know, has really shaped your worldview. So now I understand where you're coming from. I think that's a better place to start working together than to say like, you know, why do you feel like that? You know, why would you say that? Or, you know, other ways at which are destructive communication that people get into when they don't try to understand others.
Just to build on that a little bit, one of the sections in the book, you talk about construction zones versus combat zones. Maybe you can just elaborate on that a little bit for us.
I'll connect it to the news media piece. The reason why we opened the book with constructive dialogue, we kind of debated how to organize this book. And we were initially, you know, because we're critical thinking teachers and critical media literacy, we're like, we got to teach those two first and then constructive dialogue. But as we were practicing this in the classroom, we were realizing that students didn't sort of know why we were building toward constructive dialogue and that we should start with that. Essentially, you have to remember for young people, when they hear the word debate, they don't often think about what you and I might think about. You know, Scott and I here, we can get in a debate. And I think at the end, you know, we'll laugh and appreciate each other and learn a lot from each other. For a lot of young people, debate means 3-minute segments with panels of 10 people on news media shouting over each other about some contentious issue. And we say the person who won is whoever owned someone else on the argument. And if that's your conception of debate, we have nowhere to go. That's basically just destroying each other. It's very destructive. So we argue in the text that the classroom needs to be a place of constructive dialogue, one where we can disagree, but we can also learn from each other. And the title of the book, Let's Agree to Disagree, is not an invitation to accept hate or to accept insults or to accept disrespect. It's to say we need to foster a space where we can disagree. Too often we're in spaces where we're only with people we agree with. We need to make the classroom a space where we can disagree constructively. That means listening as much as it means communicating. And we talk a lot in the book about how when we conflate listening with hearing, so I hear you, right? Basically, there were sounds coming out of your mouth and now they're done, so it's my turn to talk. No, we don't want that. We want listening. I want to hear that I actually heard everything you said. I understood it. I can repeat it. I can say where I agree with you on it. Now, here's some areas where I want to challenge or push back. What do you say to this? And that's listening component is really important as well. And that's a big difference between the combat zone where you're trying to just own the other person or insult them or belittle them and things like that, which fail to change minds and fail to educate each other.
I think you make such a really good point about how young people, especially, don't really have a model to what constructive debate looks like. When we think of the U.S. presidential debates as a great example of what debate isn't that comes to mind. And there are some out there, but they're not really in the mainstream, like something like Intelligence Squared or something along those lines, where they do look at constructive dialogue. But I don't imagine there's a lot of students who are listening to their podcast. And I think having that modeled in the classroom is really important to really show students what constructive dialogue is, because they don't really have a context or just an understanding of what that looks like. And I think active listening is such a big part of that. And you just brought that up a second ago. I just want to kind of dig into that a little bit more. Like, active listening is a skill. And active listening is something the students need to learn. And I think there really isn't a lot of explicit teaching of what active listening means and what it looks like in our school system. And how, I wonder, can we get more opportunities to recognize the importance of that and really help students become better active listeners?
Yeah, it's a great question. I know talking about the future of education, Scott's a big passion and purpose for yours, which we all appreciate and benefit from. I think, yeah, kind of redesigning the way we approach the classroom. So much, particularly in high school and higher ed, is focused on make your thesis, make your argument, and you defend it. And it's so individualistic. It's so about defense rather than really change. You know, like almost if there's a weakness in your argument, you feel bad about yourself. where it should be seen as like a learning process, right? Like it's okay to make mistakes and it's important to admit errors, even in argumentation and writing. So building that space where students are comfortable with it. And rather than fixate on the argument and the individualistic level, focus more on assignments that try and have students just understand. Do you understand what this person is saying? Could you repeat their position in your own words? Or do you see how these three positions disagree? You don't need to take a side. Can you just tell us what these three sides say? Also, active listening in dialogue in the classroom. So asking students, okay, so-and-so just spoke. Can you repeat what they said? And then ask the other person, did they get it right? Did they understand you? So teaching them just to slow down, which is so important in the digital era, which always wants us just to speed up and react versus slow down and think, can be important. And a moment ago, you brought up something that all educators know is very important, which is you need examples that students can relate to in the classroom. So, you know, it's one thing for me as, you know, a white guy to sit up there and say like, hey, we just need more dialogue and, you know, we'll have constructive discourse. You guys just start modeling this. But it's something else when I bring in examples of where this is being done in the type of media that these students are using. So you brought up podcasts. I think there's a ton of podcasts out there where they have constructive dialogue from people who totally disagree and they model the exact type of behavior we're talking about in the book. And students are more likely to watch or listen to one of those and respond positively than just believe me up there with the whiteboard talking about it. And so I think bringing those examples in the class can help. And we try to bring in a diversity of them throughout the book too. So it's, again, not just a theoretical book, but we have actual examples of this work being done.
One of my favorite examples from the book is the story of Daryl Davis. Can you tell us a little bit about that story and how he used this idea of constructive dialogue in a pretty remarkable way?
Yeah, I would concur with that. Yeah, Daryl Davis is just such an interesting figure. You know, there's so much skepticism, maybe even pessimism about combating racism in the United States. And Daryl Davis is an African-American man who just exudes optimism about combating racism. And the way he tells it is that he was at a bar, a nightclub. He's a musician. And afterward, he sat with some white man who brought up that he had never had a beer with a black guy. And Daryl Davis couldn't believe this. And so they had beers and they talked about music. And after some time of building a relationship, this person admitted that he was a member of the Ku Klux Klan. And basically by using music as a way to relate, again, recognizing the humanity aspect and having civil and respectful dialogue, Davis was able to get this individual to leave the Ku Klux Klan. In exchange, this gentleman gave Davis his robe, his Ku Klux Klan robe. And Davis was inspired by this experience to reach out to Klansmen, use things like music to relate to these folks, and then through dialogue, get them to leave the Klan. And he claims to have done this to over 200 individuals and has the robes to show it. There's quite provocative images of him standing next to Klansmen in Klansmen uniforms who had left the Klan, but put it on to stand next to him in their final time with the robe. And he's just an inspiring figure to illustrate the power of dialogue that can be done. And he's inspired so many other folks to take up this work.
I think what's really interesting about him too, I watched his TED Talk. And he talks about how, like, he's a musician. He's not a social worker. He's not a counselor. He's not a negotiator. He kind of sells himself as a regular guy. And he's just approaching this with respect and as a listener and engaging in this dialogue that helps the other side feel comfortable first and to want to engage. And he talks about how when he does meet people, like, they don't always agree on things. In fact, when you talk about a situation like this, they probably disagree on a number of things, but they're having this civil conversation. And I really think that's how we might be able to revive this lost art of civil discourse, is just to be able to kind of take those strong negative emotions that thrive on social media and just bring those out of the equation and having empathy, like we've been talking about, being active listeners, and using nonviolent communication. And I think that's really what we need to do. Otherwise, we're going to be stuck with, just like you said before, people shouting their talking points and no real forward progress on any of these issues. And that's where we see this big threat to democracy.
Yeah, absolutely. We're, you know, about 30 years into this highly partisan cable news media era. We're about 15 years into this highly partisan social media era. And I never come across anyone who says we're in a better place. And I think that's important to remember. So, you know, the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting different results. So I think it's really a time for change. And in a lot of the darkness that we currently are experiencing, someone like Daryl Davis can be an inspirational figure to say, what's a different way we can go about this rather than trying to call out the other side on social media or lampoon them on late night comedy shows. Daryl Davis shows us a different way. And I think it's much more inspiring than what we're seeing in a lot of our media.
One of the terms you use in the book that I really liked was media citizens. And I wonder if you can share, how can we be media citizens rather than just media consumers?
For sure. Let's give credit to my dear sister and friend there, Allison Butler, who has pushed this concept along. But essentially, you know, in a lot of classroom, media classrooms, we use the term like media consumers. And that sort of communicates that we're just mindless people just consuming anything on the screen. And as Allison Butler communicated and we write in the book, we need to be thinking about this in a more savvy way. We need to be media citizens. How do we use these tools to strengthen our democracy? So a media consumer might sort of mindlessly share news articles based on the headlines. A media citizen might slow down, might read less, you know, quality over quantity, and interrogate the content they're looking at, whether it be a video or an article or a podcast, and say, well, what are the sources? What is the evidence? What's missing from this? Why is this important? What can I learn or do from this? And then decide whether or not to share it or what comment, if any, to make on it. Media citizens also recognize that the purpose of news media or just information in general is not really to entertain us in a democracy. Information is meant to inform us and to tell us what to do. Who should I vote for? Should I not vote? What policy should I support? Should I oppose it? Should I get in the streets and protest? Where should my attention be focused? Does this matter to me? All those kinds of questions are thanks to information. You know, I point to the George Floyd protests in the summer of 2020 after his murder. Most people had never met George Floyd, never been to his community, would have never known his story had it not been for media, right? You have this horrific video taken, you have it shared, you have it covered. And this inspired people to take to the streets, say, this cannot happen, this cannot continue. And people of all walks of lives hit the street to protest. And that's the power of media. That's what a media citizen would do with media and information. A media consumer, they just entertain, they just share, they just sort of like laugh at it or use it to brand themselves or market themselves. And so that's kind of the distinction we make in the text between the two.
I think it's so important to set our students up because students are consuming so much media at younger and younger ages. And we really don't bring this into discussions in school as often as I feel we should. And finding ways to help students become media citizens and to be curious and be critical of everything they're reading in the media because of this idea of the entertainment spin on media and a lot of things, just like you're saying, where we're just kind of sharing headlines, people aren't checking facts, aren't looking at sources, and so important to kind of help our students understand how they can kind of navigate, how can they separate that real news from the fake news. They just need those skills, and they need our help with that as media consumers, as well as media creators. We're talking about, you know, so much out there now where students are creating and sharing so much that they really need to be thoughtful and, just like you're saying, slow down as they're kind of putting these things together.
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely true that this critical media literacy needs to go across the curriculum and nothing needs to be off limits. I mean, we need to teach students all media need to be interrogated. The legacy news sources, New York Times, CNN, the blogs from Breitbart, but also the texts they get in the classroom. Just because your teacher gives it to you doesn't mean your teacher wants you to agree with it. Usually your teacher wants you to rip it apart, really analyze it, deconstruct it, if you will. And so just kind of teaching those skills that all this stuff is the same. You don't sort of mindlessly sit down and watch a film. You can deconstruct a film. There's a message in everything and it shapes our worldview. And I think that's an important skill in general, but particularly at this time. I mean, the United States is one of the most mediated societies on earth. Basically, if we're awake, we're interacting with media, whether it be a billboard on the side of the road or the cell phone everyone has in front of their face. And so teaching those skills is really, really important. And I think it's adaptable to any classroom. Some of the work I do is working with teachers, professional development. And we talk about how, you know, teachers are, especially in this day and age, burned out and overworked. So how do you integrate media literacy in place of things versus trying to add more work? And there's a lot of opportunities there. The idea of if you're teaching students how to interrogate an academic text, you could do it with, you know, media text. You're teaching media literacy and those same critical thinking skills, things like that.
Absolutely. I think there's so much opportunity in schools to bring in these ideas of media literacy and having students kind of go through some of those checklists in the book. Who's producing this media? Why? What's the purpose behind it? What are they trying to get you to do? And going through some of these different checklists that you have to analyze media and just to become more media savvy. And I think there is opportunities throughout our curriculum to do that. And I think it's just important to kind of help teachers to share resources. And your book is such a great resource for educators to kind of get some strategies on how we might bring this into existing units that they're already teaching in school to sort of level those up and help their students be media citizens through that work.
Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, dispelling some of the myths for students too, like, you know, the word critical has so many meanings, but just because you're critical of media doesn't mean you hate media. I always get a laugh out of how many of my colleagues, I mean, they just like adore probably the most embarrassing media. They would hate for me to share their playlists. But, you know, yeah, everybody, we love media. We love, you know, whatever, films, we love news, we love podcasting, things like that. But we still can pay attention to it with a critical eye. So teaching students how to do that work, I think, is really important. And the classroom is a great place to practice. You allow students to bring in the media that they're using and deconstruct it. Engagement just goes through the roof in the learning process. So I think it's beneficial all around.
100% agree. That's something that's important, is getting kids engaged and making education meaningful. And when we can look at media that they're consuming and give them some tools to help kind of deconstruct that and look at it with a more curious and critical eye, I think it's such a great opportunity. You talk about the word critical, and that comes up in a really interesting way. A bit of a riff at the end of the book where you are using critical to sort of unpack some strategies that people can use to be more savvy media consumers. You want to talk about that just a little bit?
Critical is so funny how it's shaped so much of my career. I didn't realize it would be interpreted so many different ways by so many different people. So depending on which context we're in, I could be a villain or I could be an ally. But in the text, we use critical in the sense of interrogating issues of power and becoming more knowledgeable. So if we write every chapter with one of the letters. So chapter one starts with a C and chapter two with an R and then et cetera. And so the last chapter spells out the word critical, basically be critical, and has a summation of each chapter. And what we're asking folks to do is critically think about texts. That means, you know, sort of that traditional logical investigation of text. What is the evidence? Is it well-supported argument? What are the inferences, et cetera? But we also match that up with critical theory, which is, what is the power behind these texts? Who has the power to tell these stories? Who shapes these narratives? Who are they aimed at? And the end of the text is about how you apply that to media. Both, as you pointed out, as a media user and a media producer, we often forget that students do not walk into the classroom as empty vessels. They are media literate in one sense or another. They're all using media. They're, you know, making media. They have thoughts on media. So it's about kind of working with them and finding where they're at on this critical level. In the United States, critical has a particular importance in media literacy. There are sort of two camps in the media literacy world. There's one camp, we call the A-critical folks, but just media literacy folks. They're comfortable with allying with media corporations and using media corporations as funders and using their content in the classroom. And those of us who are the critical folks, we sort of oppose that. We think you can't interrogate media texts, but not interrogate your pedagogy or resources. And so critical media literacy folks say, if you're going to bring in stuff from Facebook or Nickelodeon, you'd be wise to teach students how to interrogate the power in the production process. You know, why do corporations want to be in the classrooms is a question worth asking. which acritical folks seem to disagree with. So that's why we put critical so front and center in our text.
It is interesting you bring that up about some of these big tech giants like Apple and Google and Facebook, and we're seeing them more and more in the school and education spaces. Why is that a bit of a cause for concern, perhaps, with some of these big companies and sort of trying to drive the narrative a little bit in terms of media?
Great question. I've done some work with this with Allison Butler, and Ben Williamson's done some really great work on this if folks are looking for more information. But essentially, corporations have always tried to get into the public classrooms, right? It's one of those lucrative spaces because the overwhelming majority of children in the United States are in a classroom. So if you can get an advertisement in front of their face, or you can get them to have a positive image of your product at a young age, you can hook them, right? This was what Big Tobacco has done, and now the NFL is doing. The classroom is that space. And, you know, media companies, particularly in the 1990s, well, it predates it, but really in the 1990s, they're really savvy for understanding that these computers were coming out and cable and all this. And they're like, oh, there's this interest in getting media literacy in the classroom, right? So we'll be the media literacy educators. So you had things like Channel One and others try and enter the classroom, and they allied with, you know, media literacy experts or supposed ones. Basically to kind of, I think it's fair to say, indoctrinate corporatism into the classroom. And we've only seen that explode further and further with the moral panic over fake news, right? Everybody's looking for a solution to fake news. And I would imagine Scott agrees, are advocating for critical media literacy. Well, big tech giants are like, well, great, we can do media literacy. So you have Facebook, now Meta, where I live here in Silicon Valley. You know, they have like 1,000 educators a weekend. They're training on how to use Facebook in the classroom, and Apple and Nickelodeon and others are doing this. But what I would encourage parents to be aware of, students and particularly educators, once they're in the classroom, this is an opportunity for data collection. This is an opportunity for tracking these students. They see this as an opportunity as creating new consumers. And there's not really a lot of data to say that these students are leaving the classroom with a media literacy education. The only evidence we can see is that they're leaving the classroom more vulnerable to corporatism and exploitation from those corporations. And so I think we'd all be wise to be a lot more critical before we bring this stuff in the classroom.
100% agree. We do definitely have to come in to this with kind of our critical eye, as you say, and just be conscious of, you know, there are certainly pros and cons with all of these things, but just be able to make sure we're kind of exploring both of those sides and just really understanding what we are bringing into the classroom and how we do that. And just like anything, there are ways we can do that in a positive way and something in a little more negative way. And I love how you've talked about how bringing in some of this media that students are already engaged with and looking at that through the lens of critical media literacy, I think is such a huge opportunity for engagement with our students.
For sure. And as I get older, I pay less and less attention to the newest social media platforms. Having your students bring in content really gets you up to date on what the youngins are doing, bring in their various platforms and videos and things like that. So it's also a way to stay somewhat up to date on what's relevant.
Yeah, it gets harder and harder, I think, as we get older.
Agreed.
Nolan, thanks so much for spending some time with me this morning. It's been great to chat. I'm sure we could keep talking for a while longer, but I know I want to value your time. I'm going to link the book in the description of the podcast. It is such a great resource that you can check out if you are an educator or anyone really who's interested in critical media literacy and this idea of being able to have productive conversations with people we don't agree with, which, let's be honest, is pretty much everybody. So check out the book in the show notes. And Noel, thanks so much. It's been really great to meet you and have a conversation this morning.
Scott, it's been a pleasure to be on the podcast. I think it's a great podcast for educators. I encourage everyone to listen, subscribe, and follow. Thank you.
Hi, this is Scott. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Nolan as much as I did. Critical media literacy is such an important topic, and I feel very grateful to have someone who is an expert in this field to share some ideas with all of our listeners and talk about the importance of media literacy for students. To borrow the word critical one more time, it really is critical that we get media literacy into our schools, into our classrooms, and into our existing units. There are so many opportunities for students of all ages because they're already engaging with media and they need the tools to be able to navigate this complicated digital landscape. The Center for Media Literacy has 5 key questions for deconstructing media that I really like, that are so appropriate for students. Who constructed this message? What creative techniques are used to attract my attention? How might different people understand this message differently? What values, lifestyles, and points of view are represented in or omitted from this message? Why is this message being sent? Some great questions to help students engage with media. And just like Nolan was talking about in our conversation, this could be media that they bring into the classroom. A great way to help them in their own space and level up engagement. Something else I just want to bring to your attention is the upcoming Critical Media Literacy Conference of the Americas. This conference is going to take place in October 2022 on the 21st through 23rd, and you can attend both virtually and in person. Nolan is going to be there. Ivy and I will be presenting from Inspire Citizens on some of our eco-media programs, and it's a great opportunity to interact with some experts in the field of media literacy. All the information you need is at a link in the show notes, so please check that out, and I hope to see you there. Thanks for listening to the Empathy to Impact podcast. You can connect with Inspire Citizens at our website, inspirecitizens.org. Interact in our Flip group, which is linked in the show notes, on Twitter at ScottJ_onWheels, and please do leave a review and subscribe on your favorite podcast platform. Thanks for making a difference in the lives of students and the people in your community.
Thank you for listening to the Empathy to Impact podcast.